Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Pamela Greenwood. Pamela Greenwood is a cognitive psychologist and a long-term researcher on cognitive aging at George Mason University. Her work in this area has led her to explore on how we might be able to slow down the processes of aging on cognitive ability. We'll be discussing her work and a book written with her associate, Dr. Raja Parasuaman, called Nurturing the Older Brain and Mind. If you're interested in separating some of the myths from the real evidence on this topic, we strongly urge you to stick around and not hesitate to call and give us your questions and comments. Our local number again is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Those who have been listening to the program for a long time know that we really work hard to try to strive to find out what's real and what's not real, what's good evidence and what's not about various subjects. And I thought, after hearing Dr. Greenwood be interviewed on the Brain Science podcast, that we really could benefit from having someone whose professional life has been revolving around this issue of cognitive aging and would make a good interview. So, Dr. Greenwood, it's really a pleasure for you to take the time to be with us today from Pennsylvania, as I understand, is where you are.
Yes, that's right. Yes, thank you. Thank you for asking me. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. We've made some slight adjustments. We've got Dr. Greenwood sitting outside with a cell phone today to make a good connection. So hopefully this will work well for her and we can keep the cell phone going. Let's.
Yeah, so you should be able to hear the birds in the background here.
It sounds nice. It's a good difference from what we usually do. So what's a researcher in cognitive psychology do, I should ask? I guess is that a fair description of what you do?
Yes. I think that would be fair to say. A cognitive psychologist is really someone who is concerned both with brain and mind, but specifically from the point of view of how people think, remember, plan, just the sorts of everyday things that all of us do. So, a more basic scientists might actually study the brain, but we try to tie everything back to cognition, thinking, remembering, that sort of thing.
Let's get a little bit more specific. What's your specific primary research interests currently?
Well, currently, I've sort of changed over the last few years. I spent most of my time previously studying deficits in aging and trying to relate those to normal genetic variation. But for a number of reasons, and it isn't just me. The field as a whole is sort of slowly turning toward cataloging deficits to try and figure out what we can do about it. And this has been largely driven by some findings in the last 10 years or so, showing that the brain, even the aging brain, is much more plastic than we thought. And so if that's the case, then we should be able to develop various interventions that might help people to function better longer.
I definitely want to get into that whole area and what led you to write the book and some of the key findings that are important for all of us to hear. But I always I like to stress the elements of science a little bit, and I'd just like to ask the one question about what is it about research that's attractive to you, and then we'll move into those findings.
Okay. Research is fun, basically. It's fun because you get to ask interesting questions to which you don't know the answer. And also, you're basically working for your own glory. Everything you do is basically to your own good. So it's hard to think of too many other jobs where everything you do is sort of benefits you as well as others. So that's what makes it fun for me anyway.
You know, I think that's really important, and I don't know if we're coming around to this realization in our country or not, but it really, when we're teaching kids around science, we're often just teaching them some facts and so forth, and that really turns them off. It's really a problem-solving way of doing things, and like you said, finding answers to things that no one's known before, and it can be pretty creative, too. So it's a lot different than I think we, the way we expose kids to science, at least in the first, in grade school and high school, and maybe even in early college.
Yeah, that is true. I think we just, well, you know, but at some point you do have to get a lot of facts
right.
in your head for
right.
science. And but yeah, I think that's probably fair to say that all that they see it, but they don't see the fun, the fun parts of it. Yeah.
All right. So let's get back to the work that you've been doing, and tell us a little bit about what led you to write the book Nurturing the Older Brain and Mind.
Well, as I sort of alluded to, the field as a whole, I mean, I'm sort of changed in a sense in concert with the field. As a whole, cognitive aging researchers, you know, spent years just basically working on all the ways that older people are worse than younger people. We actually tried to link that to genes, but about 10 or 15 years ago, all this interesting work started to come out that, that really surprised everyone at the time, showing that when I was in graduate school, for example, we were taught that while younger brains are very plastic by the time you get to be in your 20s, teens, and 20s, that was basically it, that you had all the nerve cells you were going to have, your brain was not going to change, and in fact, it was going to go slowly downhill. But it turns out that's actually not true, and a lot of very nice work in various facets of this, showing that that the adult brain, and that by adult I don't necessarily always mean aging, but the adult brain is actually far more plastic than we thought. And so that, coupled with some interesting work that was then coming out about the benefits of aerobic exercise on cognition, made me start to think that maybe we can do something about this. That maybe it's time to look at all these facets together. That if the older brain remains plastic, and if diet, exercise, cognitive stimulation can actually stimulate that plasticity, well then now that starts to show us a path forward, possibly to develop some interventions here. And so I'm now working on that, but there are certainly other groups working on it also. I would say the field as a whole is sort of slowly changing now to realize maybe we can do something about this.
As we see more and more people reaching older ages than we have in the past, there's also, I think you've mentioned in your book, is what drove you to realize there's maybe things we can do to prevent some of the decrements with cognition over time, is that there's lots of people who don't seem to have any loss of function in a significant way.
Yes, that's a very important point. Again, as psychologists, we tend to look at groups, so we compare a group of older people with a group of younger people. But if you look inside those groups, and some people have done that over the years, although it's never been work that's gotten a huge amount of attention, but if you start to look inside those groups, it looks like while as a whole the older group is not performing as well as the younger group, inside that group of older people, there are older people who are functioning as well as the younger people. It's not just humans either. We see the same pattern in rats and monkeys. So this suggests that this is very characteristic of aging, that it's not a uniform process. And that certainly hints that maybe we could do something. Maybe if we knew what it was about that third to a half of older people, older rats, older monkeys, who are able to maintain functioning, then that might give us some hints about how we could actually help everybody achieve that.
Well, the title of your book is Nurturing the Older Brain and Mind, and although it may seem picayune to ask this question, so to speak, I try to make a point of making sure people understand it's sometimes very important to be precise in your definitions when you're doing science. And you talk about the older brain and mind as if they're two separate issues or there is some critical difference there. Perhaps that would be worth spending a second discussing.
Sure. So this notion, and I'm sure you and your audience have heard this before. This actually argument goes all the way back to the time of the ancient Greeks. The notion of what is the relation between the mind and the brain. It's been debated for a long time. I think it's going to be a long time before we can actually settle it one way or the other. Most people doing the kind of work I do are what are called materialists. That is, we assume that the mind is in the brain. But I think we all know that we have a mind, even though I can't prove it. I think the take-home lesson of plasticity is that we can use our minds to actually change our brains. If I choose to exercise, if I choose to learn a second language, whatever I choose to do with my life, I'm going to actually be modifying my brain. So that's why I mm-hmm. I mean, yes, someone could argue the mind, the brain, they're all the same.
Right.
But certainly we know that we can change our minds. And I think the bottom line lesson of plasticity is that changing our minds can actually change our brains. And mm-hmm. if we can bring that to the service of cognitive aging, then that's a real benefit.
Okay, good. Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Pamela Greenwood. She's a researcher, a cognitive psychologist. We're talking specifically about an area of interest that she has on cognitive aging, and in particular, the factors that may protect us from losing some cognition over time. If you've got questions or comments during the next 45 minutes or so, our local number is 550-8433. You're welcome to give us a call, 550-8433. Our email address is also available to you, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Well, let's go back to some hard structural things to ask the question about what do we know is actually happening structurally with the brain, and then we can talk about functionally what do we know seems to happen as we age. So would you mind handling those two issues before we move on?
Sure. So the brain certainly changes with age, it shrinks. however, it's important to note that shrinkage definitely appears to start in childhood. So it seems to be a lifelong process. The other thing about brain shrinkage, and I should make this clear here. I'm talking about healthy aging now.
Okay.
Alzheimer's disease, of course, is a different issue, and I would be giving you different answers for that question, but correct, we are talking about healthy aging here.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Yes, so it shrinks with age, but it's been very difficult to show that shrinkage means anything, it's been very difficult to relate that shrinkage to any sort of cognitive process. So while the brain shrinks, it doesn't actually seem to affect anything. The other thing that I should note, since we're talking about shrinkage, is that it was long thought that we people were actually losing neurons in aging. And in fact, it used to be claimed that you were losing neurons from your 20s on. It turns out that there were some methodological flaws in that work, and when you solve those problems, it turns out that normal. Again, I want to stress I'm talking about healthy older people. That there is not neuron loss. There mm-hmm. is not significant neuron loss with age. So the older brain shrinks as a whole, but that shrinkage does not appear to be due to neuron loss. The other changes that occur have to do with the white matter. Now, you all know that the brain is composed of what we call gray matter and white matter, and those terms really refer to the way the brain looks when you look at it. So the white matter is white because it has this fatty coating on it that's called myelin, and the white matter is sort of like the cables in your laptop that carry information from your motherboard to your hard drive. The white matter are actually axons, and they have this fatty coating on them, myelin, which helps them transmit faster. So white matter actually increases in volume with age until about age 50, in which point that seems to then start to lose volume also. And it's the white matter that might actually be the key to cognitive aging. So we can't point to gray matter loss for cognitive aging, and we can't point to neuron loss, but it begins to appear that we can possibly point to white matter problems. The myelin, with age, the myelin develops blisters and bubbles and areas of thinning. But the other thing that's important to note about white matter is that it is also very plastic. White matter actually increases with neuronal stimulation, and there are natural endogenous repair processes for white matter. So while it does appear to be vulnerable to age, there are these repair mechanisms as well. So that's sort of a combination of good news and bad news.
Right. You
can do something about it.
Right. So it sounds as if like a lot of focus might appropriately be looking at that white matter and the factors, including genetic as well environmental factors, that may lead us to develop more myelin or lose more myelin over time, as research in that area may help us understand changes in cognitive function over time better than just the size of the brain, is kind of what I'm hearing you say.
Yes, that's right. The other thing that does change is not and this is not the brain per se, but actually cerebral blood flow. That is how much blood is getting up to the brain. The brain uses a huge amount of oxygen, and so it does occur in aging. The capillary density declines. On the other hand, these things are certainly reversible to some extent by exercise. So, white matter integrity, we call it, and cerebral blood flow do go down with age. They are also susceptible to modulation. So, then, did you want me to talk about mind changes as well?
Yeah, but let me ask also. It's the brain's a complex organ. What about synapses, the connection between neurons and supporting structures? Is there anything else that really seems to be critically affected by aging that we need to mention before we talk about functionality over time?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is synapse loss with age, but synapses are, again, very plastic. There's been some really fascinating work done just in the last few years where they put these little windows in rats' brains so that they can image them over days while the rat is actually learning a new task. And these little spines along the axon actually form and regress over days and weeks as the animal learns the task, and some those little spines that the actual synapses are. So it's a very dynamic, plastic process that's definitely driven by learning. So the evidence on synapse loss is sort of confusing at the moment. Some people find it, some people don't. Some people say it's very weak. So it's probably not the strongest. Substrate of brain aging. And this has sort of been the problem for a long time, since we realized that we can't blame everything on neuron loss. Then the question is, well, if we're losing function as we age, which we do to a point, certainly, then we need to find the physical cause of that. And that's been sort of hard to find. White matter is actually probably the culprit, but it's okay. Still sort of a sort of early days for that.
Okay. All right. And so functionally, what do we know in the normal brain, what's happening?
Right. So functionally, probably the thing that everybody notices is memory problems. So probably working, what we call working memory, that is if you're trying to do mental math, for example, working memory does seem to undergo, you know, some slight decline. Episodic memory, remembering where you left your keys, what you had for dinner last week when you went out with a friend. These are things where we do see some decline in normal aging. On the other hand, other functions remain very intact. Vocabulary, for example, any sort of crystallized ability, semantic memory, memories for things in the far past, those all seem to be very intact. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, some of those things actually increase with age. So it's sort of a mixed group. But the thing that everybody is bothered by is the memory loss. Mm-hmm. But in normal healthy aging, it's not usually meaningful or significant.
And as you've implied earlier, it's a misconception to think that everyone is going to have significant cognitive declines over time, that many people continue to be quite alert and quite cognitive and have good executive function as they age.
Yes, that's right. Yes, as I said, most studies only look at their groups of old people as a group, but those studies who have looked inside their groups find that there are marked individual differences that many older people, the varies with the study, but let's say 30-50% of the healthy older people within a given study are not showing meaningful mm-hmm. decline. So the group is mm-hmm. so the mean of the group is lower on average than the mean of the young group,
mm-hmm.
Because there are some of the older people are not functioning well. Mm-hmm. Some of them are functioning well. Mm-hmm. So the overall mean is lower, but there are marked, and you know it's sort of an adage in the field that all young people are the same, but old people are very different. You have some 65-year-olds who are running the world, and some of them, it's a huge range for older people. And, what we want to know is why. Why
right,
is that?
Right. Yeah, that's the obvious question that's being begged here, is what's the difference, and can we affect those differences over time? And it gets back to this issue of plasticity, which you've used a number of times and we've talked about on the program in previous times. You want to kind of just real quickly also talk to us about what we mean by neuroplasticity, and then we'll move on.
Okay. Yeah, but actually, it's a term that means several different things. It basically means the ability of the brain to change itself, typically neurons. But it's not limited to just neurons either. So I can give you a couple examples of it. For example, someone who loses a limb, an arm, say, has to have an arm amputated, the neurons in the brain that received input from that arm are no longer receiving input. So it's very common for people who lose an arm or a leg to have what's called phantom limb syndrome. That is, they feel like that they know, of course, the limb is gone, but they feel like they know the limb is out there. And sometimes they'll even experience pain from that limb. And what has happened is those neurons in the brain that used to get input from that hand or arm, now they have a problem. They have no input, but they're still a functioning neuron. So typically they change jobs. Interesting work that was done by Ramachandran showing that often people who've had that happen to them, well, then if you have them close their eyes and touch them on a place on their face, that they will feel that touch as being from their missing limb. The hand area in the brain is very close to the face area in the brain. So the neuron has just shifted over, and instead of responding to the hand, which is not there anymore, now they respond to the brain. So the neuron has actually changed jobs. Mm-hmm. Another example of this is when you have neuron loss, say as from a stroke or head injury. That those neurons then are dead. You know, if you have loss of blood to an area, that then those neurons are not getting oxygen, and then the neurons die. Those neurons are not coming back. They are dead. However, there are neurons around that lesion that are still functioning. And what we have found, some really fascinating work done by Edward Taub, is if you take a stroke patient and you really force them to use the arm or hand that was affected by the stroke, that what they find over time is that if they use that arm and hand and are forced to use it, that neurons around the site of the lesion will actually start to take over a little bit of function. Now, they're never going to get back to 100%, but it's in some cases they might get back to 75, 80% of their former function. And you can map this out and work out that what's happened is neurons around the lesion have actually changed their jobs now and have come to take over some of those functions of the dead neurons. So here we have neurons that are actually changing their jobs. Another example has been it's hard to do this work in humans, but a couple of nice studies in animals showing that if you take a monkey and teach this monkey a new skill that they never learned before. There's these famous snow mountain monkeys in Japan. These are ones that like to bathe in the ocean and have snowball fights. But they don't use tools. These are rhesus monkeys. For some reason, it's not in their culture to use tools. So if you teach these monkeys to use a rake to pull in food, they show not only can they learn this, but they actually form novel connections in their brain after they learn the skill. So in that case, it's not a single neuron that's actually changing. It's a whole circuit that's changing. Hmm. So this notion of neuroplasticity covers more than simply neurons changing. And another component of this is neurogenesis, and which is only been known about for about 10 or 15 years now. When I was in graduate school, we were taught that you got all the brain cells you were going to get at birth, and that was it. You were done. But work over the years, particularly starting to pick up speed about in the 1990s, shows that certain regions of the brain are actually forming new neurons constantly. And this goes on throughout life. Many of these neurons are just sort of sloughed off if they're not used, but it looks like if the animal learns a new skill, then sometimes those neurons actually become integrated into a circuitry and really become a functioning part of the brain. So that's definitely a form of plasticity when you're actually adding new neurons to the brain. Mm-hmm.
And is it also true that neuroplasticity would encompass the increasing in myelinization that may happen in tracks because you use them a lot. Someone who is a piano player may have certain tracks in their brain that get more myelinated over time.
Yes, yes, that's a good example of it. I should mention that. Yes, yeah, so that's work done. Just a paper in Science just a couple of years ago showed that if you make a neuron fire, that you actually stimulate the myelination around that neuron. And in fact, the work that we're doing with cognitive training, and also others have seen this also, is that after someone has been trained on a task, they actually show increased myelin integrity in certain areas. So in that case, by using purely training methods, you're actually encouraging the myelin to be, we're not sure what it is, thicker, stronger, fewer holes. We don't know exactly what's happening, but somehow the myelin has greater integrity so that things flow along the length of the axon rather than leaking out of it. That's basically mm-hmm. the way that we measure it. Mm-hmm. So that's the way that we think about it.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and take our break here, Dr. Greenwood, and then we'll come back. And for the listeners, I want you to know we'll get into a little bit more information about factors that we have pretty good evidence are that are affecting these plastic changes, as Dr. Greenwood has described them, and our cognitive function over time. So let me remind once again our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break and continue our discussion with Dr. Pamela Greenwood. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest is Dr. Pamela Greenwood, who is a long-term time researcher on cognitive aging at George Mason University. We spent most of the first hour discussing some of what we know about structure and function of the brain over time and things that, and we're hoping to get into a little bit more about what the research has shown us is really truly able to perhaps slow some of this process down. I would mention that those of you who are really interested in knowing more about this, her book is called Nurturing of the Older Brain and Mind. It's really geared probably for researchers in the field, and it summarizes all the research in a very up-to-date way. But it does have each chapter a very nice, succinct, easy-to-understand comment or conclusions of each chapter, which make it easy for people to follow. But if you want to get into some of the specific research in a little bit more depth, the book is available, and the link to the book on Amazon is on our website, alaskapublic.org. I just got an email, and perhaps, hopefully, this is an email that will allow us to get into not only answering the person's question who emailed us, but also some of the factors that that you and others have been researching and looking at that may affect these changes that you have so nicely outlined in the first half of the program. The emailer is a person who is in his early 60s and says both of my parents were or are in their late 80s or 90s and have significant cognitive dysfunction. My father was thought to have Alzheimer's. for a while, but his mental function seemed to improve when he was given some oxygen therapy for a long time. And it seems like he may have had some coronary artery blockage, and so perhaps there was some cerebral arterial disease as well. His mother has significant memory impairment, doesn't exercise, and can't now remember even how to answer her cell phone. And she'd had several strokes over the past 10 years, which may have been a real confounding variable and a reason for her problems. The question is, can you address the variety of age-related and non-age-related processes that may affect brain and thought function losses? He's, the writer is saying, he's concerned about his own memory and cognitive decline genetically and so forth. So it brings up the issue of environment and genetics, and thought maybe it'd be a useful way to get into the second half of the program.
Sure. Yeah, well, it doesn't sound like either one of his parents have Alzheimer's disease. It's really hard to tell, of course, from a few lines over the phone. But there's no question that if you are a child, especially if you are, if your mother had Alzheimer's, that does, in fact, raise your risk of the disease. And there's this gene that we've actually done a lot of work on, other people have also, apolipoprotein E, which increases your risk. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that the things that we know that improve brain functioning improve brain functioning for everyone. That doesn't mean if you're destined to get Huntington's disease or even destined to get Alzheimer's disease that this is going to stop that from happening. But it does appear that these processes can be slowed, and that might be all that we can really hope for in the end. We're all going to die, of course, but some people estimate that if you could delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease by 5 years, you would dramatically lower the number of people with it, because people would then be dying of something else. They would have 5 more years of good functioning. So it does sound like this person's parents have had some significant medical problems. And he mentioned strokes and cerebrovascular disease, and of course those are major factors. But those are also factors that, to some extent, we have some control over. We can keep our weight down. We can have a good diet. We can exercise. Being heart disease, I'm sure you know better than I do, is something that can be avoided to some extent. So I would say yes, or, you know, we can't rule out the role of genes here, but I think for this person, paying attention to diet, exercise, cognitive stimulation can only be to the good. It's certainly, there's no reason not to do those things. It's a couple of studies for this gene I mentioned, the apolipoprotein E. People that have the riskiest form of this gene, by age 95, half of them will have developed Alzheimer's disease. So it's not used clinically for that reason, because it's not predictive. Nevertheless, the people with the riskiest form actually benefit more from cognitive training than people without the risky allele, but they benefit less from exercise. So you sort of get it both ways. But sort of the bottom line here is that you should still do everything that you can, to keep a healthy mind and a healthy body. And I don't think any sort of factors of a family history should really deter someone. This person is in their early 60s, I think you said, so still relatively young, and certainly time to take some steps to become more active physically, to avoid fat in the diet, and to seek out cognitive stimulation.
In the book, you're reviewing the effects of diet, exercise, cognitive training, and even some medication or drugs on affecting cognitive function over time. Which one of those would you say has the strongest evidence, or the most evidence in favor of it being beneficial. And let's talk about that one first.
Okay, well, that's easy because exercise, specifically aerobic exercise, there is certainly the strongest evidence. That's been studied longer, and it's very easy to study too. So that is definitely the strongest. It has to really be aerobic exercise. So that is, you have to get your heart rate up and breathe. And breathe faster to be getting a benefit from that. And the benefit from that seems to be really multimodal. That is, people that do that, that develop better cerebral blood flow, that's very, very important, especially with regard to their caller's father who had some oxygen insufficiency problems. It increases the levels of this neurotrophin BDNF, which seems to be important in forming new memories. It helps people avoid diabetes, which increasingly looks like, if not diabetes in a frank manner, at least increased blood glucose levels. That appears to be playing more of a role than we thought with regard to cognitive aging. It may actually be a factor in some of these individual differences that we were talking about, why some people age so successfully while others do not. There was just a paper last week, actually, I don't know if you saw it, in the New England Journal of Medicine, finding that even a slight rise in blood glucose levels has very negative effects on risk of dementia per se, you know, not simply Alzheimer's disease. But So exercise is certainly can play a major role in that as well by helping people keep a normal weight and also by helping to reduce the risk of elevated insulin resistance.
And that would be also true as we age, that continuing to exercise continues to offer benefit.
Yes. Oh, yes, always, yes. I mean, I think that everybody knows in the last 10 years or so they've discovered that even you can take frail people in nursing homes and have them lifting weights, and they benefit from that. And we were probably designed to exercise until we died. We really should be, all of us should be really active every day. The evidence is really very strong on that. And there's no downside of it. Mm-hmm. Of it either. There's many benefits, and there's no cost. Mm-hmm. There's no cost to it. So.
And it doesn't take a lot. You just have to get up and keep moving around. So the corollary there, the contra answer part of it is sitting down, not moving, watching TV, staying sedentary at work may increase the risk of problems.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, some of the nice studies that were done have been done with exercise. They simply randomly assign sedentary older people to walk 45 minutes a day, 3 days a week. This is not a heavy burden of exercise. We're not asking people to run marathons. We're just asking people, as you say, to move, to get out of your chair and move every day. So yes, it's really a low level. It's probably sufficient, but.
Okay.
But yes, and it's there's this adage that things that are good for your heart are good for your brain. Your brain relies very heavily on oxygen in blood. So anything you can do to make your heart stronger has real benefits for the brain.
The next issue I'd like to have you address is diet, and I'm really almost hesitant to talk about it. I think a diet is important, but so often when we hear the diet, we start hearing about different dietary supplements and so forth that people are being sold that helps them where there is almost no evidence or sometimes negative evidence that's not being discussed. So I absolutely, you're welcome to make comments about those things. But in particular, what are you talking about when you mention the effects of diet on aging, the aging mind, for example?
Right. So there's actually two interesting things about diet that we can talk about. One is a very powerful effect of what's called dietary restriction. This has been studied since the 1930s. It turns out if you stress an animal slightly, they actually become stronger than an animal that's not stressed. And one way to stress an animal is to actually lower their food. So if you raise, this has been shown in rats, it's shown a lot of it in rodents. I'll talk a minute about why it's hard to do this studies in humans, but it's been done in monkeys. If you limit an animal to, say, 80% of what it would eat in terms of calories if it were allowed to choose its own diet, these animals live up to 50% longer than animals who actually choose the amount of calories. They have useful blood glucose levels, insulin resistance, hypertension, blood pressure. They just remain younger, longer. So it's a very powerful approach. However, nobody wants to do it. There are actually societies of people who live at 80% of what would be a normal caloric intake. They share recipes and they encourage each other. But it's a tough way to live. So curiously, there's this guy, Mark Mattson at the NIH, who actually does this himself. You see pictures of him. It's fairly shocking how thin he is. But he has explored other ways to get these benefits without living at 80% of calories. And this is what is called intermittent fasting. It's been done. He's done this work in animals for a while, but there's a really nice study just out last month or so in humans, which they randomly assigned women to a diet where they ate a normal Mediterranean-style diet. You know what that is, of course. I'm sure your audience does also. It's high in olive oil, fish, low in saturated fats and sugars. It's a diet that all of us can very easily follow. So they did that 5 days a week, and 2 days a week they did this partial fast where they had only 500 to 1,000 calories, and it had to come from something other than carbohydrates. So it was like a partial fast for 2 days of the week and a normal Mediterranean diet for the rest. And these women not only lost weight, which wasn't necessarily the point of the study, but their blood sugar levels normalized, their blood pressure went down. They showed a lot of these more useful markers of cardiovascular health. So that's a direction that I think most people could actually manage. You could take a day or two a week and basically limit the number of carbs that you're eating. That would not be terribly onerous for most of us. So I don't see that most people are going to be willing to embrace a diet where they can only eat 80% of the calories that they would normally eat. But I think all of us could probably fast or partially fast a day or so a week. The other interesting evidence with regard to diet has to do with saturated fat. And this is very, very dramatic evidence from animals showing that if you feed a rat or a mouse a heavy, high saturated fat diet, that they actually perform cognitively more poorly. And it's not exactly clear why this is, but it's a very strong effect. So I'm sure we've all heard about these fish oil supplements and the need to eat a lot of fish because of the polyunsaturated fatty acids. So the monounsaturated fatty acids that are in, say, olive oil, LUFAs and PUFAs, they call them. But the point here is that if you're going to continue to eat saturated fat, it's the saturated fat that's going to be incorporated into your cell membranes. And not the monounsaturated or polyunsaturated fat. So you're only going to get a benefit from eating fish oil if you actually cut out the saturated fat. And then there does seem to be a real benefit. But overall, except in animals, the evidence on diet is sort of lagged behind. There was that nice study I just mentioned, and I think with regard to calorie restriction, that might be the way that things move forward. With regard to actual components of the diet, other than fat, I think it's hard to say really. But I think the evidence unsaturated fat is pretty strong, and that's again easily avoided.
Okay. Another area besides exercise and diet that I think you've been involved in specifically is looking at cognitive training. Would you define what we mean by that, and then what's the evidence for that and is being beneficial?
Right, cognitive training. So, you know, training is something that we all know about. We train our children. We send them to school. We teach them. We teach them new things, and you know, and that lasts however long they go to school, 8th grade, 12th grade, college, etc. But it's sort of a novel idea to actually work out training interventions for healthy older people. It appears that once people retire, this is a really nice study that's been going on for about 10 years, finding that when people retire, that they become, of course, you know, we don't know why exactly, but the assumption is they're becoming less mentally active. If you have a job, obviously, you have to think hard every day. Most of us do, but it appears that when people retire, that they actually start to lose some memory, lose some function. So the notion here is that if you could develop ways, interventions, just like we talked about exercise and diet, well, maybe the third leg of that stool would be some sort of cognitive intervention or training, something you would do on say a daily basis that would help you to maintain cognitive function. So, what's the evidence of this? Well, there's evidence that better educated people have lower risk of Alzheimer's disease. Now, we don't know exactly why that is, but the assumption is that there's something to do with cognitive reserve, that you've created all these circuits there in your brain from all the education, and that sort of buffers you from the ravages of aging. But we also know, and this work that's been just done in the last few years, that in children and young adults, you can train them fairly intensively on working memory tasks, and that actually makes them perform better on this nonverbal IQ test. So you're really making them function at a higher level simply by 6 weeks or 8 weeks of 1 hour a day working memory training. That seems like not a terribly onerous thing to ask someone to do. When you talk about older people, though, it's sort of a different issue because young people are used to doing what they're told, but now we need a way, some sort of intervention for older people that they will actually do. So our approach to this was, number one, to use video games or video-type games as training because they can be fun and engaging. And two, to really look for what we call far transfer. That is, I can train anybody to do anything, but the ultimate goal of cognitive training is really to make people function better in their daily lives. Can I manage my money? Can I make medical decisions? Can I solve these financial problems in my life? So I can train you to do a cute little the laboratory task, but if it doesn't help you in your daily life, then it's pretty worthless. So we've tried to develop training that will transfer to everyday functioning. So that's been our approach, and other people have also assessed that. So we use video games because they're amusing, and I know I can send you home with a working memory task, like I mentioned before, but these are pretty tedious tasks. You have to pay attention to the location of dots for an hour, or you have to keep track of what was the last blue letter you saw. But if I can give you a video game that has some of those components in it, then now you don't mind doing the training. So that's been our approach, and I think that's probably the way to do it. The problem is getting video games that are actually targeted for the abilities that we want. So it's sort of early days for that. There's no question that you can train older people, but you can train them in such a way that they improve cognitive functioning. But what we don't know right now, and we're still very much engaged in this work, is what is the best way to do that? What are the abilities that we can best train in order to train people in such a way that they will improve their everyday cognitive function?
So we're really at the very, in a sense, the early days of all of this. And I guess that's one of the caveats we should mention here.
Yes. Cognitive training is definitely the early days. Exercise, I think
okay.
we understand
right.
that.
I got
cognitive
you.
Training, yes, I think that's right. Yes.
All right. Well, we're almost unbelievably through this hour. It has been wonderful. What I want to do is always try to sum up with the key points that people can take home, and then I want to remind everybody they can get to your website and to your book by going to alaskapublic.org and looking up the Line 1 link there. But what do we want to leave people with remembering the most out of today's program?
Well, I would say if you want to keep your mind and brain functioning at a high level as long as possible, the key things are to do regular aerobic exercise to help control your weight and to also increase cerebral blood flow and to stave off diabetes, which looks increasingly like a real culprit in cognitive aging. Maintain cognitive activity. I didn't get a chance to talk about this really, but it seems like really new learning, novel learning experiences are really important. So doing the crossword puzzle is probably not sufficient. You probably need to learn a language, take a course in calculus. You probably need to really push yourself. But it's pretty early days to say for sure what the best way to do that is. A diet low fat is something all of us can do and is very easily achieved. And if those of you who are brave and want to try some intermittent fasting, that might be sort of a fun thing to do also. But it's sort of early days with that as well. So I would say exercise and cognitive activity.
Well, listen, thanks very much for taking the time to share what you've known or what you've learned and from looking at other people's research on this area with us. It's been very enjoyable. Thank you, Pamela.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You can continue to discuss this issue if you go to our website, alaskapublic.org, where you'll find a link to Facebook. Next week, we'll be discussing Alaska's childhood obesity prevention efforts with Carol Fink of the State of Alaska and Cindy Norquist of Healthy Futures. So why not tune in to your health and learn more next Monday. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and also engineer for today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.